Well, welcome to everyone. I think we'll get started. And this is the CSIS series of careers and development. We tend to do this monthly unless there's a special person passing through Washington, and we'll add a session or so. My name is Bill Garvelink. I'm a senior advisor here at CSIS. And we have with us today Tim Knight. He's the Senior Vice President for Relief and Reconstruction at, it's called Ingility Corporation now. It used to be IRG before that, International Resources Group. I don't know, did we hand out bios on Tim? Then I won't repeat it all, but Tim has a long background in humanitarian assistance, development assistance, reconstruction, both in the U.S. government and in the private sector. He worked for the Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance for a long time. He worked in the private sector, as Southern Air Transport and IRG and now Ingility Corporation. For 5 or 6 years, he ran USAID's emergency program. He was head of our DART team in the Balkans and was based in Zagreb and Sarajevo. He set up OFDA's regional office in Africa some years ago, and he worked on the International Commission for Missing Persons for several years in the Balkans, which is an interesting exercise, too. And when the U.S. Went into Iraq a few years ago, Tim and his group set up basically the first aid mission that was in Baghdad. For the first year or two, it was mostly you and your folks that ran that. So Tim has a broad experience in government and in the private sector on relief and rehabilitation activities in particular. And with that, I will turn it over to Tim.
Okay. Good morning, everybody. First of all, I'm very informal, so if you've got a question or you'd like to say something at any point, just, you know, speak up. Secondly, I'm getting a cold, so it's better if you talk more than I. The first thing I guess I'd say is really thank Bill for the opportunity to sit down and talk to people like this. I go from time to time over to Georgetown and some of the other schools and talk to graduate students about careers in international development, and particularly in the private sector. The second thing I guess I'd say is that Bill talked about this in terms of a career. And one thing I learned a long, long time ago is there are some people that are career-oriented. Bill's probably that way. He's more career-oriented. Then there are people that are goal-oriented. And it dawned on me a long time ago that I guess I was kind of befuddled when I saw everybody else getting a career. And I thought, God, how come I can't, you know, I can't quite figure out what I want to do. And it dawned on me that I'm goal-oriented. So the hard part is figuring out what the next goal is. But once I know that, I'm pretty good at getting that and moving in. And it's all worked into what looks in retrospect like a career. But I think that this field, and particularly the humanitarian side, the relief side of development and all, lends itself to that. So this day and age, I think it's very hard, especially for people that are just getting into this kind of business, to think in terms of a real career. So I would say that if you're wondering how you get into it or what you're going to do or whatever, that's very good, because this area, this field really does lend itself to people who want to work in many of the different aspects of it. So I'd encourage you that. I really got started in it, like probably everybody else that's spoken to you, just by accident. I happened to be working at AID in one office, and right around the corner was an office called the Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance, and it looked like it was interesting things, and whenever there was an earthquake or a hurricane someplace, people were all scurrying around, and it really looked like they were energized and getting things done and not confounded by bureaucracy or whatever. And so I strolled in one day and talked to the director, and it just so happened that they had an opening. All I had to do was take a huge pay cut to get it. But it beat the hell out of the bureaucratic nonsense that I felt that I had been doing for the previous 6 or 8 months or so. So I did it. And back then, especially within USAID, emergency response and humanitarian assistance was just kind of a sideline. It was something that everybody did. It was a small office, OFDA, that reported directly to the administrator. An earthquake would come up or a hurricane someplace, and people would scurry around and spend up to $25,000 immediately and then try and do some small contribution to the effort. And again, it was very much perceived as kind of this side part of development. And I was responsible for Africa, Europe, and the Middle East, which back then was really pretty slow, if you can imagine that. And like I said, the entire office had a budget of $25 million. Then the African famine in the early 80s hit, and everybody got involved. I think there were a couple of things that happened. First of all, people realized that there was a direct causal relationship between disasters and development, and that years of development work could be wiped out overnight from a disaster. Secondly, people realized, particularly with the African famine, that that this was the kind of thing that was just beyond any single government or even donor capacity to address. It had a magnitude. And it was also very graphic. There were pictures across the news every night of huge refugee camps and people literally dying in these places. And I think that people saw that there was a real need to address this in a much more professional way. One of the things that's happened over time, and I think it's a key theme in this field, is the professionalism. Those early days, there were a lot of very altruistic and humanitarian-minded people, NGOs and all, but they were, again, working on the periphery with limited resources. When the African famine hit, that all of that changed because the numbers were so big, the number of people involved, the amount of money that was necessary, the logistical constraints, all of these things were just enormous. The off-the-budget, like I said, was $25 million. My group was set up to address the African famine. We spent the first $25 million, the entire office budget. We spent $50 million that we borrowed from other agency accounts. And we got a supplemental from Congress for $137 million, I think. And we spent all of that money in about 9 or 10 months. And it was very important to show results, first of all. Those were enormous numbers back then. And it was important to try and coordinate events. So that drove the professionalism as well. I think what's happened as a result of that is that there's been much more efficiency in terms of response activities. Some of the tough lessons that we went through were we thought at that time that working with, for example, the French and Mali, the African famine stretched across sub-Saharan Africa, and the Horn of Africa was particularly affected. So we thought that, well, working with the French in Mali or Niger, we could coordinate activities and kind of maximize each other's funds. And one of the things we realized was that you have to be very careful about carving out the niche that you're going to carry out. Lots of times people would say, well, we'll pay for the admin side and the donor coordination if somebody else does the logistics. The problem is that the funding sources from those donor governments are on different timelines. So your admin system might be up and running or your logistics system up and running, but the other government that was supposed to provide, you know, the counterpart to that hadn't gotten around to it yet, or they made pledges that never came through. So one of the key lessons, I think, to learn in response to disasters is make sure whatever you carve out is something that you can carry out from beginning to end. The lure of donor coordination is sometimes just destroyed by the facts of the process of providing the money. The other thing I think that happened was that more private sector and for-profit companies got involved. And lots of times people say, I've worked for a for-profit, obviously, but I've also worked for an IO, and I've also worked as a direct U.S. government employee. and as a personal services contractor. So there are lots of ways to get into this business. Sometimes people say, well, the private sector, you shouldn't really be making money off of this kind of thing. And first thing I'd say is that the margins are very, very thin. You don't make an awful lot of money in this. But secondly, there is a structure and a discipline to private sector work that often is missing in some of the NGO work. And if you're dealing with a company that's been around for 25 or 30 years and has developed those core capabilities and has that corporate systems that can support a major overseas thing, sometimes that's better. Secondly, the U.S. government, by and large, has two mechanisms that they use to fund organizations. The first is grants. And so in a case like a big earthquake or a hurricane or something like that, Haiti's a perfect example. As soon as the earthquake hit, the government often goes out to groups that have been working there in the NGO community and gives them a grant. Basically, a grant agreement, they're saying, in the most simplistic terms, look, we like the fact that you're there, you're doing a lot of really good work, here's more money, build on it, double down, do more. The other mechanism, though, is a contract, and that's where the for-profits come in. But a contract is very different. A contract, the government is saying, we want you to do this, and we want to go out to the community and see who has the best idea on how to carry that out in the most efficient and effective way. And that's where we come in. Those are the kinds of things we bid on. As a for-profit that's, frankly, responsible to shareholders, we wouldn't bid on or go after a grant because you don't make any money. It's not a profit. You can take a fee, but it's not the same as profit. So we focus very much on the contract instruments and try to develop those kinds of things, go after those activities where we have some experience and expertise. But I think that this is a key point because in the old days, back in the 80s, probably before most of you were born, but in the old days, doing good was, in many cases, good enough. But now the numbers have gotten so big, the number of people affected and the amounts of money to address some of these problems and the impact, the longer lasting impact is so great that everybody, including the taxpayers, want to see more bang for their buck. So what I look for when I'm looking for people to carry out work, I like to find people who have some accounting, some business background. Even if they're not working on a for-profit, but you want to have people who know how to track money. A good program idea is only a good idea if you can't track it through a budget, a well-outlined budget, and then keep track of that. I have an MBA in finance, which I think is kind of unusual in the development business. You don't get many people who have the development side and then an MBA. But I found many times that the ability to track a program through a budget and a spreadsheet is really something that is not just appealing to the donor community, whether you're on a grant or a contract, but it's necessary. And believe me, the one thing that people have to realize that has happened over the years is that this business has moved very much away from pure altruism to it is a business. Whether people are with an NGO or with a for-profit or any other group, small business, whatever, it's a business. And the funds that they receive for through the government and the other donors for their office space, for their admin costs, for their accounting systems, et cetera, you have to get more and more programs to keep that business running. And I would like to think that in the private sector, we are as altruistic, though perhaps with more discipline in our systems in some cases. But the key thing is that the ability to translate a good idea in a program through a budget to final implementation. Another thing I talk a little bit about is just kind of life on the ground. Bill said that I was running the DART team in former Yugoslavia during the war. I think I was out there for about 6 or 7, 8 years total, but for about 5 of them. And I reported to Bill back in Washington. And one of the things that we had a lot of difficulty with, especially in a war, was the fact that the situation on the ground could change very quickly. Overnight, the front lines could move. There were a lot of different factions fighting each other. And so if you tried to set up a program and send it back for approvals and everything, by the time you got the money and the approvals and had found the implementing partner, oftentimes the entire situation had changed. Populations had moved or whatever. So I remember we were in Sarajevo, and there was no water, no gas, no electricity. Sarajevo at the time had a population of about 330,000 people. And it was basically a city under siege. And there were there was one area in particular that was really pretty bad. It was a modern high-rise city that hosted the Olympics and just a few years earlier. So all of a sudden it's getting shelled with, you know, 3,000 rounds a day, heavy artillery coming in, and just reducing the population to really dire straits. So what they would do in the high-rise areas, and again, no electricity, no water, no nothing, they would cut in the basement, they would cut all the pipes for the sanitation system so that everything would just drain, drop down, as opposed to wash away because there was no water. Well, as a consequence, gastroenteritis was off the scales. It was just astronomical. And no matter what intervention you brought in terms of food or whatever, you just couldn't get ahead of it. And we found that just to stop it, we found that just up the road in Croatia, we could buy enough water purification tablets that we could use and distribute to the entire city, enough for a month for $14,000. We just had to get them in. So I waited till, now keep in mind, all of the funding decisions were made in Washington. My group just implemented them. So I waited till about the middle of the night when I knew Bill was asleep.
Yeah.
And I called him up and I said, you know, we've got this situation out here. If we just had a little pocket money, we could get at this stuff, get the French to fly it in on the airlift. We could distribute this to, I forget which group we use, AICF, I think it was. And we could put a stop on this, put a big dent in this gastroenteritis problem. He said, okay, you got it. We'll worry about it tomorrow. And I waited a couple hours till I was sure he was back to sleep. I called him up again and I said, I just want to confirm that you, he said, okay, what's the point here? Bill and I have known each other for over 30 years, so he knew that something was up. I said, you know, Bill, all I need is about $250,000 out here. And then I wouldn't call you in the middle of the night all the time. Well, the next day or two, I got a fund site for $250,000.
And we changed my phone number.
And we set up what we called the Rapid Response Fund. And what it meant was that with delegated authority, we could target activities that, like that, could change people's lives overnight. And oftentimes what we'd do, we'd go into a displaced persons camp or something. And again, these were all in modern environments. These weren't camps like Africa-style camps. These might be hotels or whatever. And we could go in and we could say, maybe hand in hand with a group like International Rescue Committee, which, by the way, is just an outstanding organization, or CARE, or some of these other groups. Oh, yes, International Medical Corps. They've just hired this guy. What's his name? I forget. He just got this job there. So at any rate, so send all your resumes to him. Bug the hell out of him. But at any rate, we could go in with a local partner, and we could say to some of the people that were in the camp setting, you know, we'll provide the cash if you guys do the work. And it worked out very well, and it did. It had a side benefit that was really interesting. Because of the old socialist apparatus, a lot of times in these camps, someone, it might have been a factory setting or something, but the guy who ran the factory was kind of the king of the camp. And he always wanted to have approval and wanted to make sure that the old socialist style of him getting a little piece of the pie worked. But if you went in and in front of him, in front of everybody else, and you said, we can start this today. All of a sudden, his power was completely gone. And you could get things done very, very quickly, and the leverage that you had by being able to do this was enormous. So I think these rapid response funds became one of the most critical elements, not only in certainly in that intervention, but across the board in terms of OFDA. And I think they're used much more nowadays than they used to be. And they've actually become part of the culture of response work. That ability to, on the ground, delegate and really attack problems very, very quickly. And what I've always tried to do with people that I work with in the field is you give them that responsibility. You try and get good people. You give them that responsibility. You give them that accountability. You hold them to it, and you watch them. And if they screw up, you get rid of them. And if they don't, you put more money on them, and you try and develop others. It's the best way in the world. So if you're looking for a career in this kind of business, the lesson is you got to get out to the field. You got to get dirty. You got to spend some time out there. And lots of times, one of the best entry points is an NGO. They don't pay very much, but you certainly get your foot in the door. When people come into our office, we're looking, by and large, for somebody with a master's degree. Would like it if they've got a local language or, you know, another language that they can draw on. But we also, more than anything, want to see somebody who has worked in the field and is successful. And that is just absolutely key. If we get somebody that we really like, might not have all those qualifications, we'll get them out to the field and we'll stick them on a project for a couple of years or whatever. And then hopefully encourage them not to stick around, because it can be very, very seductive. But in fact, to go back to school and get that master's degree and focus on something else. Let's see, what else was I going to say? I talked a little bit about the fact that this is a business and that field work is necessary, and that, again, this area really does lend itself to goal-oriented people. You can specialize in things. Some people have done very well specializing in, for example, logistics or health interventions or administrative support. You can always specialize in, but I think the best thing is to dabble in a little bit of all of it, because each one of these is going to be a little different. And if you go to work for somebody and they say, we have a model and this is how we implement it, turn around and walk out, go find somebody else. They're all different. They all require a lot of flexibility and a lot of latitude. And the best ones are the ones that delegate an awful lot of responsibility to the field. That's where you want to be. That's the thing that's going to be the most satisfying and the most rewarding ultimately as you build up either your career or your series of goals that start to look like a career. Last thing I'd say I talk about is security. Back when we got started, relief workers in a lot of ways, or people implementing programs, were almost sacrosanct. They were almost, you could go into a lot of these situations and you knew that because you represented either the United States government or a large donor organization or whatever, that you were pretty safe or comfortable. That certainly changed during the African famine, because a lot of the problems associated with the famine were associated with wars, especially in the Horn of Africa. Ethiopia under Mengistu was a really rough place. Both of us spent a lot of time there. You'd walk into refugee camps in Sudan, where some of the camps had 40, 50,000 people in them. And I can remember driving up to some of these, and before you could see the camp, you could smell it. And before you could see it again, you could hear in the morning everybody coughing from tuberculosis and respiratory diseases, all these things that the worst thing in the world is get people in a camp, because then one disease or one bug just goes around. But we'd go into these places and you'd walk through a quote-unquote hospital that was just sticks with burlap over it. There was this thing back then called, I don't know what it was really called, but everybody referred to it as burning baby syndrome. And these kids would get it, and it looked like they had blisters from whatever skin disease this was. But once they got it, 2-3 days later, they were dead. It was just a certainty. And you'd literally walk through these places and see people die in front of you. And I think one of the things I'd say is that what I found is that a lot of people who are overcome by those kinds of situations, though they want to help and they want to be a participant and play a role, oftentimes those are the worst people to have in the field, because in no short order, under circumstances like that, they can't function. So you need people that are not dispassionate, but people that are able to recognize the situation as a problem that needs to be addressed, as opposed to a passion that has to be satisfied. I don't know how best to put that, but you see, you can tell in about 5 days in the field who's on one side and who's on the other. So what I was talking about security is that a lot of these situations, especially in the African famine, were associated with wars. And by the time Uganda rolled around a few years later, after Idi Amin and Milton Obote fell apart and the entire country collapsed, people in humanitarian assistance were viewed as providing assistance or solace to one side or the other. So there was a real concern about people being targeted in the humanitarian assistance field. And what I've told everybody, Bill and I have both worked in I don't know how many war zones, but what I've told everybody is that I'm obsessed with security. You don't want to come across as a cowboy, and this field has a tendency to bring out some of the cowboys in the relief situations. What you want to be is disciplined and systematic and able to adjust and make adjustments given the situation on the ground. And you want to be able to assess security, know what's going on, and look at it as a very personal thing. The Benghazi thing is the perfect example in my mind. There were unfortunately people who were led to believe, either by the Ambassador Stevens or others, that it was all right to be in this kind of situation. You have to look at it from your own perspective. And in retrospect, if you look at the groups that had already left and had decided it wasn't safe enough to work, that's when you have to personally say, I'm out of here, not going to do it. I'm very superstitious. I tell people that, you know, sometimes you look at an airplane in the field and you say, I just don't think I'm going to get on that one today. But it's that kind of gut feel, and you only get that by having field experience and seeing how in incremental steps the security situation can either deteriorate or improve. And you have to look at those little hints. Sometimes it's as simple. In former Yugoslavia, you'd notice field after field after field near a checkpoint. In one field, the grass or whatever had never been cut. And after a while, you realize, well, that's because that field is mined. And so it's just little hints like that that you have to constantly be aware of, because security, I've seen too many situations, I know Bill has and others in this room, too many situations where everybody wrings their hands afterwards and talks about what a great job and how dedicated so-and-so was, but they're dead. That's the bottom line. So I take security very seriously. It's an aspect of this business. If you're uncomfortable in those kinds of situations, or you feel as though it's much more important, or if you feel comfortable in kind of transferring the responsibility to security to somebody else, get out of the field. You got no business in it.
Well, I'll start out with one question that's a little bit different, and then while I ask him one, think about it, and we'll open it up to any questions you have. One other element in the humanitarian business that you really didn't mention that's relatively new is the military. And if you just comment on that a little bit and how you interact or that sort of thing, how you deal with the military and humanitarian situations.
That's a great question, and the role of the military has certainly changed over time. Back in the African famine days, the military really had little or nothing to do with the response the U.S. government put together. But over time, it became obvious that the military is the 800-pound gorilla in the room. They've got resources that dwarf everybody else. And I think the key thing is to recognize they are going to play a role, especially in parts of Asia in the old days, the military were the only resources, and so OFTA would go to them oftentimes for help. But they are going to play a role, and I think the key thing at the most senior levels is to identify, co-opt them, find out areas that they can work in, and oftentimes logistics is the very best thing, especially in huge response activities. They have a logistics system that just is so much more superior to anything I've ever seen. They can move large amounts of stuff very quickly. Once you tell them you want it done, it's going to be done exactly the way you told them. So you have to also be cognizant on the field of having that latitude. The other problem, though, is that once they get involved, especially at the senior levels, they want to really drive the show. What I always thought was the best was the relationship on the ground. There was a guy, Mike Hess. I don't know if any of you have ever met him, but Mike Hess was a colonel in the civilian military program in former Yugoslavia. He was a reservist. He later became the head of the DCHA Bureau that includes OFTA and OTI and the others at USAID. But
he was my boss for about a year.
He was your, yeah. But he's been a fixture in this for a long time, but he really started out in the reserves. And I got to know him when in Sarajevo, I came home. My group lived off the land. We didn't have any, but we just rented local apartments and lived there. And I came home one night and a mortar had come into my apartment. And when I opened the door, this thing is just sitting there. And, you know, it definitely changes what you're going to do that evening. And so I radioed Mike Hess, and he sent a couple of guys over, and I said, you know, can you help me out here? So they disabled this thing and took it away. And believe me, that's a bonding experience. And so Mike and I got to be really good friends, and we've worked closely over the years since then. And like I said, he headed up the DCHA Bureau for a little while. So that local one-on-one relationship with local military is often the most effective one. After that, I had to speak at a military group one time, and I think I got Mike in trouble because they asked me about military cooperation and everything, and I said, you know, after that, Mike and I would sit down, we'd have a couple of beers, and we'd talk about, gee, if we could get some resources to do this, that, and the other thing. And some officer raised their hand and said, was Mike drinking in uniform? Oh, sorry. So anyway, but if you can establish those kinds of relationships and take advantage of that flexibility at the local level, that's really the best situation. The higher level, it gets harder and harder. And like I say, they want to dominate. But if you can give them a task and identify clearly what it is, and oftentimes logistics and transport, things like that, are the very best thing, then it can be beneficial. It's an interesting topic because it's going to constantly evolve. And the bigger and more attention an event gets, the more the administration, especially some administrations, are going to tend to turn to the military and say, get this over there and fix it. And unfortunately, it's the kind of thing I think that aid really has to keep their eye on, because USAID's administrator is the president's representative by law for disaster response. And if they're not careful and they don't carve out that relationship very clearly, they're going to end up abrogating that responsibility, and the military is going to take it over. And a military response, in case anybody hadn't noticed, sometimes isn't always the best response. And it changes the entire tenor of the situation. Just one last quick story. When the troops went into Iraq, I drove up through Basra. A friend of mine and I got a car. We were in Kuwait, I guess it was, and we just drove up through Basra. Back then, you could go in and out, and we watched the troops move in, and there was this wooden school about the size of this rectangular square area, whatever it is. It was all wooden and glass. I mean, nothing fancy about it. And the CBs were there, and they were, you know, sawing windowsills, putting doors back on. I mean, just really basic stuff. And there was a perimeter of U.S. military around this thing while the CBs were working on this school. And the military perimeter was making sure that the local population, everybody was protected. But the local population was fascinating. I mean, can you imagine after all these years of Saddam Hussein and everything, American military shows up, and they're in your village working on stuff. And occasionally a local guy would get a little closer or something, and I remember there was this one woman, a military soldier. She had an M16 slung across her, and she sleeves rolled up, and anybody would get close, she'd bark, "Get back, get back." And, oh, my God. And, you know, it'd be so easy to pick two or three of these guys and tell them to come up here, and you saw this thing, and you hammer this. I thought, if this is a metaphor for the war, we're in serious trouble. And I think in many respects, that's exactly what happened. The first thing we did was just isolate ourselves from the local population and not engage them. If you do that, you're going to lose. It doesn't matter what kind of an intervention. If you do not engage the local population from identification of the idea all the way through implementation, you're ultimately going to fail. I think you're absolutely right. See, this is what he's good at. It was interesting in the former Yugoslavia. My group, as I said, lived off the land and everything. The embassy was based in Vienna, I think. There wasn't an aid mission, so we were pretty much on our own. And we had Nissan patrols, diesel Nissan patrols, soft skins. We could go just about any place and quietly go, you know. Then all of a sudden, when things started to settle down, the Dayton Peace Accords were signed, the mission and the embassy came in. And the next thing we knew, we could no longer use these soft skin vehicles that we had been running around in throughout the war. Now that there was a peace agreement, that we had to have these Suburbans that were had light armored packages on them. Now, like I said, Sarajevo hosted the Olympics. Winter Olympics, and the reason they did is because they get a hell of a lot of snow there, among other things. And when they put these Suburbans together, they didn't put heavy-duty shocks or heavy-duty brakes, but they did add about, you know, 800 pounds of armor on these things. So we're going up and down these roads, and the rear shocks would go, and whoever was sitting in the back, just, you know, you had to have a helmet just to, because of the roof of the car. And the brakes were terrible. They were all automatics instead of sticks. I mean, everything. But it was the imposition of this security thing. And somebody sitting back in Washington who'd never been out there had said, "You know, this is a dangerous place. We got to make sure these people are protected." Well, what they did was implement regulations. And that's just one example of how this can really get out of hand. I think in a lot of cases, the immediate step is to come back to a security posture that is prohibitive. And that's why it's really good to have people on the ground like yourself in Libya who understand the local situation, can assess the security situation without bringing in, you know, heavy vehicles and all and drawing more and more attention. It's a fine line, and you've got to know where that line is. But I think we have hamstrung ourselves in many cases by imposing security that is just way beyond. The other thing that's interesting is that in a lot of the contract activities that I was talking about earlier, especially some of the things we recently bid on, we didn't bid on Syria, but Syria was a program that came out. Libya was one. But in situations like that, the government has oftentimes turned and said, in our request for the proposals, you're responsible for security. You have to identify the appropriate security profile, what kinds of vehicles, et cetera, and you are responsible. The government will not be held accountable for any injury or death or whatever that comes about. But then on top of that, they say, however, it has to be adequate and appropriate in case a direct hire U.S. government employee is it. So that automatically raises it. And then they tell you, on the other hand, well, and we want to make sure we're judging you on cost, too. So we want to make sure you don't spend too much money. They really put this, everybody's confronted by the same dilemma. And everybody's trying to sort it out and figure out how it works. And frankly, there are some situations where I'd argue if the security is that bad, you shouldn't be in there. Nobody should. Let them settle it out for a while and then go in.
If I can just add one thing, maybe a little bit of a different perspective. I agree with Tim completely on the way security can be too much of an issue, and it hampers things. On the other hand, I spent a few years as the ambassador in the Congo, in Kinshasa, and If an official American is hurt on your, or killed on your watch, there's an inspection that goes on, your career's over with. So security is sort of the foremost concern of every ambassador for every official American. So there's an infrastructure and a hierarchy back in Washington that you do not take chances with official Americans. So that's one of the first things an ambassador thinks about in the morning all day long if you're in a conflict area like I was in the Congo. So there's another side to that security issue if you're part of certainly the official U.S. bureaucracy in the foreign affairs community and State Department or AID. But it's a primary concern of any ambassador who's overseeing a program in that kind of area. So it's sort of forced on you.
Yeah.
Because you pay a heavy price if an American is killed on your watch.
And the other thing that's interesting about it is if you are working under a contract, you fall under chief of mission authority, which means that by and large you have to follow all of the requirements that the chief of mission sets out through diplomatic security, even though you're a contract employee. If you're working under a grant, you don't necessarily fall under chief of mission authority. So what the government does lots of times, aid will say, okay, well, we're going to do this activity. We want you to do it this way, but it's going to be a grant. So, you know, they're playing both sides against the middle, which it really isn't very fair. But that's when I say it really comes down to a personal sense about do I have any business in this situation or not? Hmm. What branch are you in?
I'm in the Navy. I've done humanitarian response.
Yeah. One of the things that really has come out on the military side, one of the things that's come out in, not too long ago, but the training exercises the military does oftentimes are associated with humanitarian. I think that's been very, very helpful. It gives both sides, you know, the military is going into it with a training attitude as opposed to a mission attitude, which is a big difference. And it gives the civilian side a better opportunity to work with them and see what their capabilities are. It really comes down to personalities on those things. Now, talk about personalities. The worst thing in the world you can do, I suspect, when Sean Penn shows up is diss him or, you know, I haven't got time for you, Sean, whatever. You know, that's not going to be good. That's going to make the headlines. You're going to be looking for another job. And it does seem to be this, you know, this cultural thing where everybody has to have their own cause celeb and send somebody out to deal with it. Good news is that lots of times they can raise an awful lot of money and focus the attention on some of these things. Dealing with them and, you know, surprise, surprise, a lot of them have enormous egos. Dealing with them can be a little tough. We didn't have too much trouble with that in the former Yugoslavia because there weren't that many people that were too interested in it, especially when it was hard to get into, it was heavy shelling and all. I remember one time that when I was working at the International Commission on Missing Persons, Bianca Jagger had a real interest in the program. And she showed up in Sarajevo in the middle of she was going to come, but it was a horrendous snowstorm. And she only had one day there. And she ended up really late. It was like a middle of the night. She finally got into the place and we were going to meet at like 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and the snow was just horrendous. I mean, the snow out there was unreal. So at any rate, she called where I was living and says, "Is there any way we can get to talk by? I'm leaving at, you know, like 8 o'clock in the morning." And I thought, there's no way in hell I'm going out in this snow and everything. And I said, "Well, why don't we get together on the next trip when you come in?" So I told my brothers that story, and they said, "Hold on a second. Bianca Jagger called you from a hotel and said, can you come over and talk? And you said, no, what's the matter with you?" So sometimes circumstances are just fortuitous enough that you don't have to deal with them. But you have to engage them. The worst thing in the world you want is that news thing where you dissed or you become the representative of the United States government in that case or the organization or whatever. And if you don't come through, believe me, all those people that have been backstopping you in Washington, D.C. will cut you loose in a heartbeat. So you do have to engage them. They're a fact of life. You try and put them in the right point them in the right direction so they can help raise money or bring attention to a really bad situation.
Yeah, if I can just add a comment about that. We had a number of folks coming through the Congo I was there from 2007 to 2010. And some of them are a real pain in the neck you have to deal with, and you just have to, as Tim said. But some of them are pretty good, too. There's two people in particular in the Congo, Ben Affleck, who has his own NGO, and he has programs in Eastern Congo. He has professional staff working who really know their stuff, and they're very good. And he is very helpful, and as Tim said, they can reach another person is Ashley Judd for PSI. They know what they're talking about. They do their homework. They engage and can be helpful with the government, and they raise a lot of money, and they can touch, as Tim said, they can touch areas of the U.S. population and international population that we can't. So it's a real mixed bag, but if they're really serious about what they're doing and they take it seriously and they understand the problem and do their research, they can be really, really helpful to what you're doing.
Yeah. Over and over and over. People show up. They have no place to stay, no resources, no this, no that, and they're a burden. And oftentimes they're driven by this altruistic thing. I got to get over there. I saw these kids starving. I have to go help. I know I can. If 1 out of 100 work out, great. But it's the worst thing in the world is just show up. If you have no resources, no place to stay that night, no water, no food, you're just taking it from somebody who's there who's really working hard and knows what they're doing. I don't know how to say it any more bluntly. Don't do it. But you can always find a wire somehow. Somebody's connected to somebody. And if you think you can participate, go through an organization that has the infrastructure, the minimum, to keep you alive and help you do your job. Otherwise, give them cash. If you really feel that committed, give money.
Please join me in thanking Tim for talking to us.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Thank you.